Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the things we have going on over there. There's a lot of podcasts. Maybe that's your New Year's resolution if you made one of those. Maybe it's to listen to more podcasts. Probably not. You probably were like, I got to listen to less podcasts. But maybe you were like, I got to listen to more podcasts. And if that's the case, that's a place to get them. And if you want to support all those podcasts, a New Year's resolution that you could also make is to support the podcast that you listen to. You can do that over at 1517.org or over at ChristOldFast.org. And we would appreciate it. Thank you so much to those who did support the podcast in 2018, which was by far, Chad, the best year for this podcast. We grew, we more than doubled in 2018. So the podcast numbers are humbling, and the fact that it's continuing to grow it's an awesome thing. So we're looking forward to 2019, but we are still plugging away in the desert. And people are, I think that's a shocking thing, is that the podcast grew exponentially in the book of Numbers, Chad. Now that's the backwards ways of God.
Yeah, that is the backwards ways of God. Yeah, who would have thought that Numbers would capture so many people's attention?
I wasn't surprised. You know, people were pretty interested in Leviticus, because I think that people find that book a little maybe confusing, and so they're like, yeah, I need to figure that book out. Numbers, I've never heard anyone say, I really got to figure Numbers out.
I've never met the person who thought that Numbers was their favorite book of the Bible. I mean, maybe somebody's out there, and maybe now that we've been spending all these weeks in it, people have changed their mind. I mean, there's certainly a gold mine here as we've discovered. But I mean, I wouldn't have said the Numbers was my favorite book starting out. I'm still kind of a Genesis Exodus kind of guy. But yeah, it's working its way into my heart, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, where do we leave off in 2018?
Well, we kind of left off with some bad news. This was the story of Moses and Aaron. We tend to focus on Moses and Aaron messing up here with the striking of the rock and being banished or being banned from entering the Promised Land. But it's actually Moses and his brother. This incident is not only the reason for Moses dying outside the Promised Land, but it's also the reason that Aaron died outside the Promised Land. So kind of keep that in mind. In fact, in my Bible, that section in Numbers 20 is highlighted as the sin of Moses. But as we'll see in the latter half of Numbers chapter 20, Aaron is also blamed for what happened there, and for that reason is not going to enter the Promised Land. So that's where we left off, Numbers 20, those first 13 verses at the waters of Meribah, the waters of contention. So we will pick up here with Numbers chapter 20, verse 14. There's a couple of sections here in the latter part of this chapter that deal with two different scenarios. One is the death of Aaron at the end of the chapter. But before we get there, we have to cover a bit of a squabble here between the Israelites and the Edomites. So this is picking up with verse 14 and taking us through verse 21. Starts out by saying that they're at Kadesh or Kadesh, which is where the prior events in the chapter happened as well. Miriam died at Kadesh, and that's where you had the waters of Meribah as well. So they are camped there. They haven't moved, and they're about to cross over into the land of Edom. That's their plan, because it's the shortest route to where they're going. So they're of course coming from the south, but they're not entering the Holy Land at the southern border of the Holy Land. What they're going to do is they're going to go around. If you can kind of picture this in your head on a map, if you kind of have that map of Israel in your head, they're going to go east, over and around the Jordan River, where the Jordan River would flow south of the Dead Sea. So they're going to come at, eventually, they're going to come at the Promised Land from the east. The shortest would have been from the south, but because of a number of factors, they're going to go all the way around to the eastern side of the Promised Land, and that's where they're going to enter. But We got a ways before we get there, and a number of challenges and battles and other events that transpire between now and then. So anyway, back to Numbers chapter 20. They want to go over the land of Edom. So Moses is trying to be very diplomatic here. He sends messengers to the leader, to the king of Edom. And he kind of summarizes what's been happening to them. He says, it's kind of interesting the way it starts out. He says, thus, this is Moses writing to the king of Edom. He says, thus your brother Israel has said. That's interesting. Right away, by calling the Israelites the brother of Edom, he's trying to remind them of their shared history. Because, of course, Israel is another name for Jacob. And Jacob's brother was Esau. And Esau is the father of the Edomites. So Israel and Edom is another way of saying Jacob and Esau. So their family history, their family history is shared. I mean, they came from two brothers. And so Moses, when he sends these messengers, starts out that way. Thus your brother Israel has said. And here's how he summarizes what's happened to them over the last few centuries, actually. He says, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice, and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. And now behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. So he summed up their history. Here's what happened to us. All these bad stuff happened, but God redeemed us. He brought us now to where we are, and we are actually at the edge of your territory. So he begins by introducing himself as the brother. Then he kind of tries to elicit a little bit of sympathy from his brother by describing what's happened to them, as well as indicating that, hey, this is what God has done for us up to this point. Excuse me. And then he says this. Then finally he makes his request. And his request is real simple. He says, please let us pass through your land. We shall not pass through field or through vineyard. We won't even drink water from a well. We're going to stick to the highway, which is called the King's Highway. We won't turn to the right or to the left until we pass through your territory. Now, you know, that I think, at least from our perspective, that might make perfect sense and be almost overly diplomatic, right? All we want to do is walk through. We're not going to eat of your food or drink from your wells, nothing. All we want to do is get from one side of your territory to the other. We're not going to cause any problems. But Edom is refusing to let this happen. Their response compared to the Israelite request is very short and very blunt. Edom says, you shall not pass through us, lest I come out with the sword against you. So a big fat no. But Moses, again, tries. He says, listen, this is verse 19. We will go by the highway, and if our livestock does drink any of your water, we'll even pay for the water. All we want to do is pass through, nothing else. And Edom's response this time is even shorter. You shall not pass through. And not only that, they not only said no, but they came out against them with a heavy force and with a strong hand. And so ultimately, Israel was not allowed to pass through their territory. And Israel was forced to go around a long way to get around the land of Edom rather than passing through it.
This seems somewhat understandable. I'm trying to think of back in the day. I mean, even in modern times, if somebody was like, "Hey, we have a couple million people, we want to march through your country," we won't do anything. I mean, most countries would be like, no, I'm not comfortable with that. No, seriously, we're just like, stick to the road. We're gonna just go through. There's a couple million of us. Don't worry about it." The request isn't unreasonable, but the response is not completely unreasonable. There's a reason in that day, especially when, I mean, all combat is hand-to-hand and all that sort of thing, where you're like, a couple million people, just like letting them in? That could be, if these people are not acting in good faith, that could be a really bad deal.
Yeah, and I think that's probably part of what's going on here, is that no matter what Moses and the Israelites say. There's still that doubt as to whether they're actually going to do what they say, or whether this is nothing more than a subterfuge by which to get into their territory and then attack them. Whatever the thinking of Edom was, they are not going to take the risk, and they're going to defend their territory, despite the fact that they are brothers historically, and despite the fact that there was a reconciliation of Jacob and Esau after Jacob returned from exile, and everything seemed to be fine, but that was a long time ago. You know, that was hundreds of years before, and so I guess the Edomites, rather than remembering that reunion and that reconciliation, they're going to focus upon the current threat instead. So that's you could say that's sort of the beginning of a long-standing and oftentimes very bloody conflict between the Israelites and the Edomites that lasts all the way up into the first centuries of the last centuries BC before the incarnation. So there's some very, very bloody episodes on occasion where the Edomites, for instance, join with various enemies in order to take advantage of Israel's weakness and to sack their cities and to destroy the people, do all sorts of really horrific things so that some of the prophets speak out against them. It's sort of, I guess you could trace a lot of that enmity back to this particular episode here, where they didn't let them pass through their territory.
Yeah, I mean, the sons of Jacob and the sons of Esau still don't get along.
No, they don't. Yeah, I mean, you can just you can watch the news, anything about the conflict in the Middle East. Well, yeah, you can sort of trace it all the way back here to Numbers chapter 20, if not even prior to that. Let me mention one other tidbit. If you happen to be reading along or looking along in your Bible as you're covering this, there is an interesting possible alternate translation here for one of these phrases. So verse 14 starts out saying that Moses sent messengers to the king of Edom. And then in verse 16, when Moses is describing what happened to them, he says that God heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. At least that's my translation. Now, the Hebrew for Moses sending messengers and the Hebrew for God sending an angel is exactly the same. The verb is shalak, and a messenger is a malak, or in the plural, malakim. So if your translation has angel, that's certainly a possibility. The angel of the Lord was very, very much active in the redeeming of the sons of Israel. But there's also a chance that actually this angel in verse 16 is a reference to Moses himself. Because just as Moses sent messengers to the king of Edom, so also God sent a messenger to bring the Israelites out of Egypt. So there's a pretty good likelihood, in my opinion, that this should actually be translated as that God sent a messenger, namely Moses, to bring the Israelites out of Egypt.
That's how I've always understood it. And I always thought it was interesting that, you know, Moses sort of writes third person there.
Yeah, because he's speaking, of course, through his messengers. And he doesn't even mention himself directly, except possibly here.
Yeah.
So I didn't notice it this morning until I was looking at this again, that the Hebrew is actually the same between Moses sending messengers and God sending a messenger or an angel. So I think this is probably I don't want to call it a mistranslation, but kind of an ambiguous phrase that probably should be translated as God sent a messenger to bring them out of Egypt. Because many times Moses is described as the one who brought the Israelites out of Egypt, because of course God was doing, but he was using Moses to accomplish that.
Yeah. And we don't know anything about an angel being involved. It's an angel of death. That's it.
Right. The angel of death in Exodus chapter 12. But, it makes more sense to understand this particular angel as actually just a human messenger, namely Moses.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So, finishing out the chapter, beginning with verse 22 through 29, we have the death of Aaron. It says that they do finally leave Kadesh, and They travel to a mountain that's called Hor, H-O-R, and it's by the border of the land of Edom. So they can't pass through Edom. They're on the border of the land of Edom. It says there that that God tells Moses and Aaron, quote, Aaron shall be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the sons of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. It's kind of ironic because back in verse 10 of that chapter, Moses and Aaron say to the Israelites, listen now, you rebels. And in verse 24, God says that actually Moses and Aaron rebelled against his command at the waters of Meribah. So even though Moses and Aaron claim the Israelites are rebels because of their actions, because of their unbelief specifically, they themselves are called those who rebelled against the word of God at the waters of Meribah. So that's a verse I was referring to earlier when I said it wasn't just Moses that was kept out of the promised land because of his sin, but also was Aaron himself. So there's a prophecy, or not a prophecy, but actually a direct indication by God that Aaron is about to be gathered to his people, which is the Old Testament idiom for someone dying. So it's time for basically for the office of the high priesthood to be transferred from Aaron to his son Eleazar. So God tells Moses to take Aaron and his son Eleazar and to bring them on top of the mountain and to strip Aaron of his garments. These garments are almost certainly his high priestly vestments, that elaborate outfit consisting of multi-layers and all sorts of headgear and a belt and other things that we talked about in Leviticus. So they're supposed to take all that off and put it on his son Eleazar. And then Aaron will be gathered to his people and will die there. And so that's what they did. Verse 27, Moses did just as the Lord had commanded. They go up on top of Mount Hor inside of all the congregation, and Moses strips Aaron of his garments, puts him on his son Eleazar, and Aaron dies there on the mountaintop. And Moses and Eleazar come down from the mountain with Eleazar wearing the high priestly vestments of his father. And as soon as the congregation saw that, they realized Aaron had died, and they begin a period of mourning that lasts for 30 days, which is a long time. We know from other biblical passages that the typical period of mourning was 7 days, like official mourning, where there'd be ceremonies and various, I guess, liturgies of lament, whatever was connected with the funeral back then, and mourning for the death of a loved one. But this more than quadrupled that. So this was 30 days, which was the same period of mourning that would later be observed for Moses. So both Aaron and Moses are, because of their importance, are accorded an inordinate amount of time for ceremonial official mourning on behalf of the nation. Miriam dies at the beginning of this chapter. Aaron dies at the end of the chapter. And the only one left really of that that special generation, if you will, the first generation that came out of the land is Moses. And he's going to be with us at least to the end of Deuteronomy. But time-wise, that seems like a long time away because we're still in Numbers. But time-wise, it's very short because this is the final year before they enter into the promised land.
Yeah, I mean, so Moses and Aaron really are here. I mean, they're the last people, probably. I mean, they're the last two people that were in Egypt.
Almost certainly, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a big deal.
Moses lived to be 120, which even back then was quite a long life. So chances are he actually is the last living person who had actually been in Egypt. So he's the bridge between that prior generation and the current generation, the only one who's left. So we wrap up chapter 20 then with the death of Aaron. And chapter 21 begins with the section that we have actually already covered, as strange as that might seem. If you're a brand new listener to the podcast, you might not realize that at the Here We Still Stand conference in San Diego. Every year, we have a number of live recording of podcasts, including 40 Minutes. And this year we had a we always have our guest and friend Eric Sorensen on with us, just like we did at Christmas on that episode from 30 Minutes in the New Testament. Well, we also had Michael Heiser from the Naked Bible podcast join us for that discussion. And I think that was, I was looking this morning, I think that was like between episode 137 and 138, sort of a special episode.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be, it's labeled Live from HWSS, I think is the name of it, if you just now jumped in or something.
Yeah, so if you just now jumped in, you can go back and check that one out. We did that for we covered that one for a number of reasons, mainly because, I mean, we covered this upcoming section in that podcast for a number of reasons, but mostly because it's one of those texts that ties very nicely between the Old Testament and the New Testament, because it's the story of the bronze serpent and the fiery serpents and the bronze serpent and its connection then with John chapter 3. So, and at the beginning of that podcast, if I remember, we actually covered those first three verses of chapter 21 as well. So if you're looking to hear more about the fiery serpents and the bronze serpent and its connection to Christ in John chapter 3, then check out that particular episode. That'll be covering 21 verses 1 through 9. So that leaves us, after we jump across those verses, that takes us to chapter 21, verse 10. Now, this is interesting in a very different kind of section than what we've covered so far in Numbers. This is one of those sections where, like, if you're ever in a Bible study or in worship and you're asked to read the lesson, this is like the one nobody wants to read because it's full of all of these very, very hard words to pronounce, like Ovoth and Iyeabarim and Wadi Zered and Arnon. And there's probably at least 20 words in these few verses, place names mainly, that are extremely difficult to pronounce. And not only difficult to pronounce, but they're very difficult for archaeologists and other biblical scholars to identify. I mean, we have that with, especially with some of these older stories, like we're looking at in the Pentateuch, where it's difficult for scholars to actually be able to pinpoint, okay, this particular place or city or wadi or whatever it might be, is the modern equivalent of blank, whatever
right.
that might be. I mean, we can do that a lot of times, but it isn't always so easy, especially with these older stories like this. It's basically a travel narrative interspersed with some interesting other material. Verse 10 starts out by saying that the sons of Israel literally pulled up stakes. I don't know if that's where we got that phrase from or not. Your translation probably says something like, now the sons of Israel moved out or moved on or something like that. But the literal Hebrew literally is they pulled up stakes. That is just like, you know, when if you go camping and it's been a long weekend, you've been sleeping in the tent, it's time to pack up everything and head back to the house. Well, you get to pull out your tent stakes if you're going to take the tent down. So this became an image for moving on. So the Israelites pulled up stakes, they moved on, and they began their journey working place by place slowly toward the area where they're going to be on the other side of the Jordan. So they camp at a place called Ovoth, and then they journey from there to a place called Iyeabarim, which is opposite Moab. And then they camp at a place called Wadi Zered. A wadi, W-A-D-I, is I was trying to think of what we call them in Texas. Something like a dry gulch or something along those lines. It's basically, most of them are dry creek beds that only have water in them, running water in them during the, you know, after a heavy rain or during the rainy season. So if you have a wadi, then you have a place where water might be, but will probably only be during the rainy season. So they leave there, and they camp on the other side of the Arnon, and they're close to Moab and the Amorites now. And then in verse 14, we have a reference to a book that we really know little, if anything, about. So verse 14 starts out this way. It says, "Therefore it is said, in the book of the wars of Yahweh, in the book of the wars of the Lord." And there's this quote here. It's only about 5 lines long. And all it really does is mention these place names, Waheb and Sufa and the wadis of the Arnon and the slope of the wadis that extends to the site of Ar and leans to the border of Moab. Which, I mean, to me and I think to most of us really makes no sense. All it does is reference this particular place name. So there are, at least to my knowledge, 2 different books that are referenced in the Old Testament that we don't know anything about except for those particular references. There's the, I'm forgetting about the one, able to come to me. Oh, yes, the book of Josh, well, it's said different ways, J-A-S-H-A-R, Joshar or Yasar, is referenced a couple of different times in 2 Samuel as well as in Joshua 10. And there's some quotes from the book of Yasar there in those biblical text. And then we have a reference here to the book of the words of the Lord. Now, what these seem to be are some kind of collections of songs or poetry that were the Israelites' way of putting to music, putting to poetry, various aspects of their journey and over the early years as they worked their way toward the promised land. So for instance, this one that's from the book of the wars of Yahweh is only 5 lines long. At least that's what's recorded here. Chances are it was even longer in the original, but it's been lost. We don't know anything about how long these books were or how long they were in Israel's possession or when they were lost or anything else about them, except for what's been recorded here in Numbers 21 and then the 2 Samuel passage and then in Joshua, where you have reference to the book of Yashar. But it's kind of an interesting, I think, bit of trivia, if you will, that there were, besides the Bible, what we have in the Bible, there were other books in ancient Israel, which to a greater or lesser extent recorded some of the experiences of Israel and translated those experiences into poetry so that the Israelites, by means of poetry and probably by means of singing the poetry, were able to commemorate and to remember what God did for them in their journeys toward the promised land.
Yeah, these seem like almost like history songbooks. So it's both a collection of songs or poetry, and it's also a book of history. It's recording your own history.
Yeah, and you know, we have in the Psalms themselves, we have a number of Psalms that do this as well. I think of Psalm 89, Psalm 135 and 136, as well as several others. Well, especially Psalm 135 and 136. What they do is basically they retell the story of the Israelites as they were in Egypt and then rescued from Egypt and then worked their way through the wilderness and eventually entered into the promised land. So it's actually very instructive for us, because when we think about history, even the history of the church, but certainly just history in general, I don't think that most of us think about turning history into a song, even though we do have historical songs, even in our own national heritage. But most of the time, when we think of history, we think of just something that happened in the past, right? That doesn't really affect us today. But for the Israelites, their past was the place of divine activity on their behalf, as well as a place in which they rebelled against him and were either disciplined or punished, disciplined or forgiven. So they very frequently will use history, will put history into a poem and use that poem or hymn as a means to remember what they did, what they experienced, and most importantly, what God did for them. You know, at least in America, we've done the same thing with a number of songs, but the most well-known would be the Star-Spangled Banner, which commemorated a battle between the British Navy and the Americans at, I think it's Fort McHenry in the War of 1812. So that particular song has its origin, has its root in a military conflict. And so by the singing of that particular song is the way that Americans not just commemorate that particular battle, but commemorate the history of the nation and various principles on which the nation was founded. Now for Israel, it's different because when they commemorate battles and when they commemorate what God has done for them in history by means of song, they're actually directly confessing that these events took place by the hand of God. God was in these events, bringing about victory for them, bringing about redemption, and bringing them finally into the land that He promised them.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a little excerpt from this book that we don't know anything else about, called The Book of the Wars of Yahweh. And then it continues verse 16 by saying they went from there to a well, which is translated in, I always thought this was funny, and well in all the English translation is translated as beer, B-E-E-R, Be'er in the Hebrew. So they go to Be'er, that is the well where the Lord said to Moses to assemble his people and give them water. And then we have another song that Israel sang at this particular point. After that, we go into verses 19 and 20, which wrap up this particular section. So it's a little bit different. It's not what we're used to, this travel narrative in verses 10 through 20. But for the Israelites, it is important because each step of the way for them is not just history, but God's continued protection of them and blessing of them as they work their way toward their ultimate goal. Now, we're going to jump to verse 21 and pick up a story that it and the story that follows it are heard again and again throughout the rest of the Old Testament. So this is first 21 through 32 is the story of Sihon, king of the Amorites. And then 33 through the end of the chapter is the story of Og, the king of Bashan. So the longer of these is 21 through 32, which tells the story of Sihon. And here's basically what happens there. It's sort of like Edom, except in this case, they don't pass around this particular land. They actually conquer the king as well as the people that inhabit the land. So Israel sends messengers once more to this king, to Sihon, king of the Amorites. And their request is very similar to Edom. They want to pass through the land. They said, we won't turn off into the fields or vineyards. We won't drink from your wells. We'll go by the king's highway. But Sihon wouldn't permit Israel to let this happen. And so he gathers all his people and he goes out against Israel in the wilderness and he fights against them. Now, so here's the situation. They have to pass through this land in order to get to the Jordan and cross over the Jordan in order to conquer the promised land. But standing in their way are the Amorites, and standing in their way is Sihon. So one way or another, there's no going around it. In other words, they have to conquer it. And that's what they do. Israel goes out against them with a sword. They take possession of the land and they kill the king of the Amorites, and Heshbon, which was evidently the capital city or the biggest city of this particular area, is the very first city that the Israelites are able to conquer. So this becomes extremely important for the Israelites as a sign that just as they conquered this city, now they're getting ready to conquer the cities that are on the other side of the Jordan. So very frequently in the rest of the Pentateuch and a number of the Psalms, in Joshua and in Judges, I think I counted this morning, 34 different references to Sihon in the Old Testament. You're going to hear his name occur over and over because this was an extremely important event for the Israelites. This was like the confirmation that they needed, that God indeed was blessing them with victory and would continue to bless them as they got closer and closer to the promised land. So that takes us through the 32nd verse of that particular chapter. And then we wrap up here with the last few verses, which tell the story of one more significant battle, and that is against Og. Og, my son likes to follow the strongest man competitions, and I think Og should definitely be the name one of the competitors. Og was one of the last of the giants that we have referenced in the Old Testament. There's a description of his bed in the book of Deuteronomy. He's which was, if I remember correctly, about 6 feet by 13 and a half feet. So this was a giant sized bed for a giant sized leader. And Og is said to be one of the last of the Rephaim, which are those that are accorded magnificent size in other parts of the Old Testament.
I need a bed that size.
Yeah. Well, you're taller than average. You need that extra height.
Tell you what, man, me and the mattress struggle are real. There's every time I go to a hotel, I'm like, dang it.
It's like you just need an extra, I don't know, 2 feet at least.
Bummer. It's a bummer.
I mean, when you're tall, your feet are there at the edge of the bed, and you gradually pull up the sheets, and mm-hmm. then you wake up in the morning, and your feet are cold.
That's it. That's what happens. Also, baths are just like out of the question for me. It's so bad. I can't take baths. There's no bathtub for me.
Yeah, it's like when you get into a shower, and it like you're looking at the shower, you're looking down at the shower head.
This happens to me a lot. I turn on the shower and I get hit like right in the chest with the water. You're like, this is a bummer.
Just we'll take a bath. Well, that was Og's problem. And so you can imagine the trepidation of the Israelites facing a giant like that, much like the Israelites were later afraid of Goliath. But as they did with Sihon, so they did with Og as well. He is conquered. He's the king of Bashan. And they killed him and his sons and all his people, and they possessed his land. So Israel is bit by bit, battle by battle, working their way toward the promised land. And that's where they're going to be when we pick up next time. They're going to be right there at the edge, except it's not over yet, because we're just about to be introduced to one of the most comical, interesting figures in the book of Numbers, whose name is Balaam, who, if you remember the story, is hired as a prophet to curse the people of Israel, but things don't go his way, and he ends up having a conversation with his donkey, as well as being unable to fulfill his mission because God actually reverses that mission to something completely different. So it's a very interesting story, and that'll be actually more than one chapter. We'll begin there with Numbers 22 next time.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting about like these battles. At least initially, you see that these aren't exactly battles that the Israelites want to fight. These are battles because these kings won't let them pass through. They're not just showing up like, all right, we're going to kill all you guys just for the heck of it. They have to get through, and they won't let them. And that's where the wars come from.
Yeah, it wasn't like they were just warmongers who were out for blood. They wanted to pass peacefully through Moab. They want to pass peacefully through Edom. Their goal was the conquest of the promised land, not anything else. But as it turned out, they were forced to engage in battle. And as a result of that, they were able to win territory, which actually was later to go to a couple of the Israelite tribes. So we'll pick up there next week and hear all about Balaam and his donkey.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks for joining us. Hey, do us a favor. Go over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast. That actually helps us out a lot. gives us more visibility. So if you haven't done that and you actually like the podcast, you know, 5-star reviews only. If it's not 5-star, then, you know, don't do that. But, you know, if you got one of those 5-star reviews in your back pocket, might as well spend it on us. Chad, we will see you next week.
All right. We'll see you then. Thanks.